Thanks, Johannes, and everybody here, Daniel, everybody who helped me get set up, David, Annalee, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. I'm like most of you these days. If I can stay home and just watch it streamed live, I'll do that too. So all of you who are out there streaming live, the reason I decided to be here, though, in person is that one of my favorite pieces of the road is from Santa Barbara to San Francisco. So I was very happy to do it. Michel de Certeau enjoined us to tell theory as a story. And I think that's what I try to do. Since the topic today is narration, you're going to be hearing some stories that I hope has some theoretical implications. The title of my talk is Fuck Space, Slashing the Ocean. Now, we're not going to get to the ocean until the end. But I remember Yvonne Rainer's film about a woman who, the last line, you can always have an ocean ending. I'm going to start back in 1996 when I wrote an essay called From NASA to the 700 Club with a Detour Through Hollywood, Cultural Studies in the Public Sphere. And it was in a collection that was supposed to be a follow-up to the gigantic Pink and Black Cultural Studies collection that became everybody's Bible for so long. And the book was called Disciplinarity and Dissent in Cultural Studies, and it was edited by Carrie Nelson and Dilip Gangkor. Now, the book sank like a stone. Maybe too much alliteration and assonance in the title, Disciplinarity and Dissent in Cultural Studies, which is a shame because I really liked what I did in my essay. And there were some other really good people in that book, too, Lynn Spiegel, Paula Treichler, Andrew Ross. So anyway, here's what I did in that essay, because it bears on what I'm going to be doing today. And so I'll just start off by reading just a little bit of the beginning, as soon as I find the right glasses. In April of 1993, I heard that Pat Robertson, in a 700 Club special on godlessness in public schools, had denounced the course that I teach on pornographic film. It's the course I've been teaching since 1993, so he got on it early at UC Santa Barbara. He first called my course a new low in humanist excess, which I'm using as a blurb on my book. And then he went on to say, a feminist teaching pornography? That's like Scopes teaching evolution. So yes, the greatest compliment of my life, and I get it from the Reverend Pat Robertson. Okay. That same day in April that I got denounced by Pat Robertson, I got an invitation to present my research on women in space at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech. And that coincidence made my day. I mean, those of you who know my work know that I spent a great deal of time and thought on popular science and sex in America. So this really convinced me that I'd finally kind of arrived, you know, into odd public spheres that I wouldn't have otherwise thought I would be. But as it turned out, I was on a roll. While my pornography course got written up in every mass circulation publication, from Reader's Digest to Playboy, from Hustler to The New Yorker, and I'm not necessarily going from low to high there, my newly appointed chancellor at UC Santa Barbara had just arrived on campus, and he was the Neil A. Armstrong Professor of Aerospace Engineering at Purdue. And He asked me if I would like to be nominated to the astronaut corps. And a bit later, just after that, I was asked to be an expert witness in a federal obscenity trial of some adult videos. And this was a trial in Louisville, Kentucky, and some of the titles were Gay and Kinky, Three Guy Ass Attack, Girls Who Eat Cum 7, and Kinky Anal 2 were just some of the finer titles. So then, I mean, these things just followed one after another. A Hollywood documentary production company approached me and Linda Williams to appear in and be consultants on The Skin Game, Porn in the USA, a theatrically released film that would survey the current state of the industry, the ongoing legal battles around obscenity, and the most recent humanities and social science research on sexually explicit images and their uses. A friend of mine said that my essay for Disciplinarity and Dissent in Cultural Studies could be entitled Connie's Big Adventures in the Public Sphere because it fashioned three stories about my attempts, successful, failed, and inconclusive, to take that kind of cultural studies work, the kind of work I do on popular science and sex, into other public spheres, all kinds of other locations. Now, I'm not going to get into everything that happened with my getting nominated to the astronaut corps, serving as an expert witness in federal obscenity trial, or the ill fate of Porn in the USA, The Skin Game, one of many documentaries about pornography that I have tried to get made that have not get made, including one you will see, a little bit you'll see today. So what I'm going to do, what I want to do here, is tell you some other stories, and once again, successful, inconclusive, or failed, about more recent attempts on my part, and almost always in collaboration with others, to inject ideas about popular science and sex into public spheres, spaces, and institutions where they are not usually found. The first one, these I'm just going to really talk about briefly. We're first going to go to adventures in network television, and then an attempt for on HBO, the documentary division. It's not TV, it's HBO. NASA again. When I was invited by the National Air and Space Museum History Division and the History Division of NASA headquarters to give an update on my book, NASA Trek, Popular Science and Sex in America. This was last October in Washington, D.C. at a conference on the 50th anniversary of the space program. Okay, so, and then we will get to the ocean ending. Could we go to the NPR site? Okay. Some of you may have seen this project before. It is something that started off as a minor hack and ended up as a, I may have a chance to talk about this tomorrow too. We can talk about that later in fuller detail. It started off as a minor hack, and this project ended up as a major collaboration between a group of artists and television producers, initiated by the artist Mel Chin. We managed to get onto the set of Aaron Spelling's primetime soap opera, Melrose Place. We were given the script of Melrose Place. as part of this collaboration. It turned out that one of the executive producers of Melrose Place, Frank South, who went on to even greater things, Baywatch Hawaii, when approached about this collaboration, turns out he used to be a performance artist in New York in the 70s. Now, I've seen the tapes. I think it was Bad Cabaret, but, you know, we'll let it go at that. But it was at the Kitchen and, you know, places like that. So it started off at CalArts in the University of Georgia, and the gala committee that put this together stands for Georgia and LA. So what we ended up doing is we were given the scripts. We never once gave away any of the secrets of network television, what was going to happen to Kimberly's brain tumor or Allison's pregnancy. But we were able to, and the process of it is extremely interesting. It all started off as a commission from MoCA for a show on Uncommon Sense, where they commissioned six artists or groups of artists to make pieces that would engage in complex negotiations with some community of Los Angeles. And the community of Los Angeles that we engaged in was the fans of Melrose Place, a soap opera, of course, located in Los Angeles. By the end of our project, and I'm just going to show you just a couple of examples, by the end of our project, we had managed to place 200 objects into 45 episodes of Melrose Place. And because we had the scripts, we were able to go through and grid them out, you know, for our product placements, as we call them, you know, so that they could interact. You could go to continue. Where you could interact with, we wanted the pieces to kind of galvanize whatever place in the show where they appeared. So we had lots of great locations, a doctor's office, an ad agency, a dress boutique, a hospital, the Melrose Place apartment complex, and we had many great characters to work with, bad doctors, corrupt advertising people, just, you know, all kinds of, you know, murder and mayhem and everything that goes on Melrose Place. And so as much as possible, we tried to intersect with the themes of Melrose Place. We also were given our own character, the character Sam, who's just moved out from the Maryland Shore, got her degree at RISD. This was all written into the script for us, you know, and so we were able to create her artwork and create a backstory of art world intrigue that she would get enmeshed in. Okay, so I'm just going to give you, like, a couple of examples. Go to select episodes. Go to Great Sexpectations. Okay, here are just three of our pieces that appeared in that episode. I'll go very quickly through them. I'll just hit on a couple of them here. The cigar box in the middle. We made many pieces for future audiences, international audiences of Melrose Place. I'll show you another one of them. This is the Cuban cigar box. The hinges, the bronze hinges on it, they're in the shape of gunboats. And the hinges go all the way around the box. The box cannot be opened. Okay. And this down here, this dartboard that was in the shooter's bar, the whole thing was an installation for us, is the 18 to 49 women's demographics that are the demographics for Melrose Place. Okay, Daniel, could you go to select episode? I mean, I'm sorry, select artwork. go to safety sheets. This was our very first piece. The first person we worked with on the set was the set decorator, and she was just so happy to get free art. So she said, you know, and could you go on Zoom there? Yeah. She said, why don't you, we're going to have a steamy bedroom scene with Dr. Peter Burns. Why don't you make a set of bed linens for him? So these are quite beautifully printed, and those, of course, are unrolled condoms there. And we did the whole duvet set. And you are not allowed to show an unrolled condom on network television. And Daniel, could you just click on the movie? It's really good dialogue, too. Okay. Let's go back to Select Artworks, and we'll just do another one very quickly. And if you could click on Zoom. Whenever we had the characters on Melrose Place would get takeout, we would always have them get a Chinese takeout. And the inscriptions are, they're in the older form, not the newer simplified version. And they say things on them like turmoil and chaos, which are the current euphemism in China for the events of Tiananmen Square, environmental movement, equal rights. And so try clicking on the movie, even if we can't get sound. Melrose Place at any given moment is playing in at least 60 countries around the world. So we know that when the censors are looking at Melrose Place, they're not going to be looking at takeout bags. I mean, Maxine Hong Kingston saw me present this once and said that is so great because it's the older script on there. You know, kids will have to run and get their parents to tell them what's on those bags. And we've got some other scenes where Sam, our character, is really holding it up like that. So it's a really nice poster. Okay, and just one more quickly. Oh, the RU486 quilt. Okay, because we had the scripts, we knew what was going to happen with Allison's pregnancy. No matter how powerful you are on network television, you know, whether you're Murphy Brown or Roseanne, if you're pregnant, you can talk about having an abortion, but never have one. You know, they're so worried about the sponsors and the advertisers. And so you either have a baby or you fall down the stairs. So we knew there weren't going to be any babies on Melrose Place, but as with safety sheets, we were trying to get some speech about reproductive choice back on to network television. So if you want to click on the movie, so for two entire episodes, we wrapped the pregnant Allison in a beautiful quilt that we made that is the chemical formula for the still controversial RU486. Okay. Maybe you don't need the sound. And when I say we made these, we were working out of CalArts, out of the University of Georgia, and out of Grand Arts in Kansas City. So faxes for an idea of a piece might go out from CalArts, CalArts brainstorming section. It would get talked about further. This was really kind of, you know, early internet. So we did a lot with faxes, and then maybe sent to Kansas City for fabrication, and then back to CalArts to be taken over to the nearby Santa Clarita set, where a lot of the network shows are shooting now because it's more expensive, less expensive than Burbank. Okay, no piece went on unless at least three people worked on it, and this proved to be. And nothing was signed. There were no names on it. This proved to be controversial in a number of ways. We had to get special dispensation from Richard Koshalik, who was then the director of MOCA, because MOCA won't show student work. And we refused to distinguish among the students, the professional artists, the scholars who had done the work. This also drove journalists and curators completely crazy. Okay, now, and there's lots more about that. These movies that we have on our website here, we did not ask permission from Rupert or Aaron, because we felt, we insisted, we were not paid one penny for any of our work, not one penny. Even once they tried to give some money for one of Sam's paintings, and we refused. We believe that we so wove ourselves into the intellectual fabric of Melrose Place that why should we ask permission to use our own work? Of course, we would absolutely love a lawsuit. Talk about fair use. This would be a good one. And all the publicity we could get. Before people were talking about viral video making or viral advertising, that was kind of our working metaphor for ourselves, where we wanted to be a nice mutation, a benign infection into Melrose Place and its audiences and its fans, who could choose to pick up on this as much as they wanted to or not. Although there were some of us who also had the working metaphor that parasitic flesh-eating virus. Anyway, okay, so that was, I think, a completely successful collaborative intervention. We dealt with, in a lot of the other pieces, there's issues of violence in Los Angeles, the U.S., around the world. A lot of the pieces dealt with public health and public science issues. And, of course, you know, sex. Okay, now, the next foray into cultural spaces where we aren't usually lucky enough to find ourselves. And I just realized, did I give you the HBO disc? This one here. I mentioned earlier that the attempt to make this film, this documentary on the porn industry and porn aesthetics and porn scholarship had fallen through. Since then, I've had many, many times of trying to get a documentary made. The one that I talked to you about earlier, you know, pretty much had the fate that every other documentary that we tried to make had. These were very good people. I mean, they had done documentaries on skinheads, on women on death row in Texas. I mean, these were serious documentarians. And so they interviewed me, they'd been in a class of mine, they had seen the presentation on pornography that Linda Williams and I had made at the Telluride Film Festival in the early 90s, and so these are smart people. They come back with a script, and what we would always say is, we want three things. It's got to be sexually explicit, because you can't make a documentary about pornography and be coy about the labor that the people are doing here. And it has to be truly historical, and it's got to have the gay stuff in it. So I cannot tell you how many times they would come back with a script, a treatment. Young girl from the Midwest gets off the Greyhound bus in the San Fernando Valley, It's the day in the life of a would-be porn star. You see maybe 30 seconds of an old stag film, and then the producers will say, that's history. And then they say, oh, and by the way, you know, we really can't be sexually explicit because we can't get it rated for theaters. And then they would say, oh, and we really can't do the gay stuff. So finally, it looked as if I was going to get my wish. I was the academic talking head in the HBO series Pornucopia Going Down in the Valley. And Sheila Nevins, the head of HBO Documentaries, liked what I did so much, the historical and theoretical commentary. You can still catch it. It's on HBO all the time, a six-part series that is ethnographically not bad at all, I think. And so she liked it so much that she said, why don't we do a spinoff? You know, and it'll be called Porn 101 with Professor Penley. And, you know, and it can be sexually explicit, or at least the hard R, which is what HBO Late Night is. It can be historical. We want to put your syllabus on film. And of course, it'll have the gay stuff in it. As one friend of mine said to me after it was all over, it was always too good to be true. So, we wrote, shot, edited Porn 101 with Professor Penley. Sheila Nevins hadn't looked at any of it along the way, and it was just a dream come true. They spent I don't know how much money tracking down film clips of things I'd been looking for a long time, so it really helped my course too. And my course is a complete survey of the genre, the industry of pornography, starting with like French brothel films from the teens right on up through the internet today. So when she saw it, she said, you know, Constance was really great as a counterpoint to the porn stars, you know, but it's just still a little too much, you know. What we don't need another professor here. She's just fine. We need a porn star. So instead of me in these fabulous sets, three sets, that's SETS, in a quite lovely Garfield Marx suit. Instead, Porn 101 with Professor Penley was redone as Porn 101 with Katie Morgan. And Katie Morgan was a kind of breakout B porn star from the original Pornucopia series. She's like kind of like the Carol Lombard of porn. She's really pretty smart, but you know, she has this totally ditzy personality. So now I'm going to show you. What I wrote was re-narrativized as for Katie Morgan as this is the history of my porn ancestors. Okay, so let's play it. Just a little bit of it.
Okay. Am I back? Okay. Ready? Stupid robot. Stupid now. Stupid like you have no tomorrow. Oh, give me over. That's me. Fans are always coming up to me and saying, oh my god, I came watching you. And I'm like, well, that's my job, and that's why I'm here.
So, you succeeded in infiltrating command headquarters. How ever did you do it?
I did it like this. And I know I might be a 21st century porn star, but I feel like I've been here before. And I don't mean me, well, not personally, but someone like me, naked, having sex, with other people watching. I owe a big debt to my porn ancestors, so I decided they deserve their very own television show. Only half an hour long, so I'm going to skip some of the boring stuff and cram in a lot of other juicy stuff pretty quickly. Did that sound okay? I mean, let's face it, when it comes to what we need in this life, there's food, shelter, porn, and not necessarily in that order. One thing's for sure.
It's been very discombobulating for my students. I didn't tell anybody about this because I don't like to talk about something until it's done. So students of mine who, you know, former students, I now have like thousands of them from all the previous years of teaching porn, who saw it, were just flabbergasted because it's you know, they have clips of just about every film that I show in my class and in the same order. And there's even there was something that I said in it about what I learned from my father shortly before he died, you know, knowing of my interest in this. He told me that those stag movies, those smokers, were shown at the Lions Club, you know, there in Mount Dora, Florida. And that, so at the Lions Club is in here, coming out of Katie Morgan's mouth, you know, and so it's very eerie for me. But while one friend said it was always too good to be true to finally get it on screen, and this does have the gay stuff in it, you know, this does have... It's really historical. It's not a teleology leading up to the so-called golden age of porn, because in my syllabus, the way I teach it, that is a anomalous blip in the history of porn, the big budget theatrically released films of the 70s. But another friend, a film historian, said it could have been worse. So that's where I am on this. You know, that's how I try to measure my success with doing Porn 101 with Professor Penley. It was too much to, it was always too much to hope for, and it could have been worse. Now, I am going to, for time, I'm going to skip over or just talk about my kind of return to working on thinking about NASA in an in and as popular culture. I want to talk about a project that I've been doing at UC Santa Barbara called Digital Ocean. Those of you who know my work know that I've done quite a bit on trying to understand NASA's role in popular culture and how NASA has failed and sometimes succeeded in fashioning its own popular appeal, that is, interest in what, you know, NASA's mission, NASA's science. I was just all of a sudden in the dark here. Okay. Everything that I wrote about NASA and why I could get away with speaking extremely critically about NASA as when I spoke at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory was because I always took the stance, and I was indeed a fan of NASA. And in my work on fan culture, I know that nobody knows the text better than a fan, is more appreciative, and no one is more critical than a fan about how something ought to be changed to make it better. So it's that kind of tough love approach that I've always taken to NASA, and I think that's why I've been able to get some space, you know, get some place with my criticisms of it. However, when I and my most recent criticism of it was that NASA still has to Bush's 2004 vision of space exploration, back to the moon, to Mars, and beyond, which lead balloon, they absolutely failed to articulate a reason to go back to the moon, a reason to go to Mars. NASA commissioned in 2003, 2006, and again in 2007, a market study for space exploration. And what the study found out was that that crucial 17 to 24-year-old demographic that NASA needs to reach has zip interest in space exploration. 27% of that demographic doesn't believe, they have doubts that we ever went to the moon. 10% are sure we didn't go to the moon. NASA has been trying to, they always think if we could just, explain our science, our mission to people, if people could just get the science, they could get it, get the adventure of the science. What I did when I did speak at NASA headquarters was to give them a kind of update on where I thought NASA had was succeeding in getting its vision across, being popular, and where it had utterly failed. I think that the most recent failure, and when I say failure, I mean pandering, rather than genuinely trying to be popular, just pandering. Remember the Not the Teacher in Space program? NASA wanting to do the do-over of the Teacher in Space program and Chris McAuliffe's death. And Barbara Morgan, in all the lead-up to her mission, they said she's not the teacher in space. She's a former teacher who trained as an astronaut who's going into space. And then as soon as she was successfully and safely back on the ground, she was the teacher in space, and NASA got its do-over. Andrew Gumbel, a British journalist, called Barbara Morgan Jessica Lynch in space, albeit a willing propagandist, for the space program. The one place, and I bet there's people in here who know about this, where NASA has been successful, and it's been through NASA Ames. It is the only part of NASA that has understood that people don't want to watch NASA go into space. They want to go into space. They want to participate in that. The only thing that's been successful with the younger demographic has been the Mars rovers, where you could go to your computer, and see them. So at NASA Ames, under Pete Warden, who's the head there, they have completely understood participatory space exploration. They have in downtown San Francisco and in Second Life, they have something called the CoLab. Any of you involved in this at all? Okay, and it is really trying to. It's setting up projects for people to be able to go in and do code for future missions. Just people like us. They also have been at NASA Ames. They've done Yuri's Nights, which is a worldwide celebration every year of the space program. It often looks like reporter said, I couldn't believe it when I went to NASA Ames for Yuri's Night, and it looked like Burning Man. And then I realized that some of the pieces I was seeing had been at Burning Man. You know, so they are working with Google on the Lunar X Prize at NASA Ames, $25 million for whoever can build and land on the moon, a lunar rover. And NASA Ames is also much friendlier to the so-called the new space movement, you know, both the private and nonprofit space enthusiasts. So they really are trying to understand that people want to go along. When I spoke at NASA headquarters, there were people there who had no idea this was even going on at NASA Ames. You know, so I was able to bring NASA some news about itself. My life is pretty much consumed with this right now when I'm not doing, you know, porn, is ocean science. I'm the co-director at UC Santa Barbara of the Carsey Wolf Center for Film, Television, and New Media. We call it the house that Roseanne and Law and Order built out of our main donors to this. One of our main areas of programming is something we call the Environmental Media Initiative. And it is, it emerged from the recognition that there's no other University of California campus and there's no other campus anywhere that has such exceptional strengths in environmental science on the one hand and media and communication studies on the other. So it's really an experiment in putting together environmental scientists and media and communication scholars drawn from the arts, the humanities, social sciences, on projects at the beginning rather than at the end. So we're all asking the kinds of questions that we ask. One of our biggest projects right now, research projects, we have many other areas of public programming and teaching, is a digital ocean. And what we are trying to do here is, and I was able to bring this language to these marine scientists, you know, how would we go about building a fan base for ocean conservation? You know, how could we, bring in that kind of interactive, participatory activity, you know, where people come in and want to contribute, you know, want to join communities, you know, and how could we, use existing social networking infrastructures, wikis, Twitter, Flickr, Facebook, MySpace, all the others, to be able to create not the digital ocean, but a kind of network of networks, you know, that could be used, how do we go into, like when you look on digital Earth, Google Earth, all the green and brown spots are being mashed up, mapped, overlaid, everything is tagged. But when you look at the ocean on Google Earth, you just see blue. You know, so what we're trying to do in building this fan base for ocean science and ocean conservation is, you know, get communities of people to put data, images, and stories into the ocean. You know, and so I have become so, and I'm finishing up here. Okay, that's exactly what I have. Okay, so I have been, so we've been working on this with Google and National Geographic and the Public Library of Science and Creative Commons and the Internet Archive, EPALS, NASA Globe, on trying to make this happen. And in one of the activities that we had, we got together a large number of marine scientists, early career marine scientists, to see how they could make use of this. We found that they were using, all these social networking technologies all the time, but not in their research. So we wanted to get together a group of them to try to see how could you use this in your research, and also how could you pre-publish in DigitalOcean. Marine science doesn't have any kind of pre-publication. They all have to go through the science journals. It takes a year and a half. No access to it, very little access to it. So we got together this group, and 12 of them, there are 12 of them, and 10 of them were women. And that was the first time I found out that women are all over marine science. Most of the upcoming marine scientists are women. And so far, this is only just anecdotal and conversational, but they all had a story about being disappointed about space exploration, and being shut out of space exploration, and all the ways that NASA has mismanaged the meanings of women in space, which I use as a stand-in for the whole world of science and technology. And so their adventure, their science, was going to be in the ocean. It was going to be ocean exploration. And they were going to be aquanauts, I guess you would say. So here was a way that, there was, I understood how important this was to them. What I also understood is that it is crazy. I've now become an ocean fan. It is crazy that we spend so much on exploration of outer space when our lives, our climate, everything depends on the ocean. We're spending so little on that. And this is the last thing I'll say, where I fucked space and turned to the ocean, to slash the ocean, was in February of this year when Michael Griffith, the head of NASA, shilled for the Pentagon at a press conference saying, yes, we had to shoot down that spy satellite. Okay, NASA is a civilian agency, right? Saying we had to shoot down that spy satellite, because what if it came to Earth and killed people? Well, there's never, ever, ever, ever been a chance for that to happen. It's never happened. And, of course, the Chinese had just shot down what they said was a weather satellite just to test their missile shooting down capabilities. And so the Pentagon wanted to do it, too. So Michael Griffin shilled for the Pentagon. What he said was untrue. Okay, so that really brought home to me that the reason why we're in space rather than under the water is because we want to piss on space. In other words, space will probably be weaponized one day, and we want to make sure we're there, and we also want to make sure we can shoot down other people's stuff. So anyway, I used to be a NASA fan, but I'm not much anymore. Now I'm an ocean fan. That's my ocean ending. Thank you.